Where No One Has Gone Before by Leodan 14, read by Cookie Mom 6067. Chapter 1, Stardate 34895.3/2. Joe. Counselor Alkazani, the board computer bleats violently in Joe's ear. It is 0650. Joe groans, pulling his pillow over his head. Once more, he's fully missed the 6 o'clock, 6:15, and 6:30 wake-up calls. No time for breakfast, just like yesterday. Counselor Alkazani, the computer yells. I'm awake, Joe mumbles, and the digital voice quiets. Thanks, computer. You're welcome, counselor. With a deep sigh, Joe pushes himself out of bed. He would claim that being in space fucks with his inner timekeeping, but the truth is, he's never good at getting himself out of bed in the morning. In an ideal world, he wouldn't have a single appointment before 10 in the morning. This is how he schedules his appointments as well. No good counseling can happen before Joe's brain is fully online. And as hard as the computer tries, replicated coffee is just not the same. Still, Alpha Shift begins at 7 sharp, and Joe's not about to give DeGeneva another chance to make disparaging comments about his professionalism. He stumbles to the bathroom, takes a piss, and then attempts to comb both his hair and his beard into place simultaneously. He sniffs at the blue uniform shirt on the floor, pulls it over his head, pulls on his pants and boots, and makes it to the bridge just as the chime for the start of Alpha Shift goes off. Already standing in his customary position above the captain's chair, legs wide, arms clasped behind his back, Chief of Security Nicolo DeGeneva doesn't even flinch when Joe walks in. He probably gets up at 6 on the dot to comb all his hair precisely into place and iron his mustard yellow uniform. We're not actually in military, you know that, right? Joe mutters to him for the second time this week as he slides into his bridge position, which is a sort of casual lean against the first officer's chair. I see you've forgotten your comm, DeGeneva responds, just like he did yesterday. Again. Same old DeGeneva. Reliably as shit. Not for the first time, Joe resists the urge to do a read on his emotional state to figure out if there's something actually wrong with him, or if he's just like this naturally. His father claims he should let go of all professionalism and use his betazoid abilities to read moods like his dad reads minds. Joe refuses to do that in the workplace unless it's therapeutically necessary. It feels intrusive, even on a shithead like DeGeneva. At 7:03, the turbolift doors slide open and Niall and Andy enter side by side, already laughing at some joke Niall must have told previously. Morning, Andy sing-songs, sprawling across the captain's chair like her bones are made of rubber. Who knows, they might be. She's always been kind of cagey about her ancestry. Joe shoots DeGeneva a dirty look. No comment on the captain's tardiness, apparently. Status report? Niall prompts, legs primly crossed. She'll make it maybe half an hour before the pansexual sprawl sets in. The ensign at the helm reels off their current location and course, as well as their projected arrival time at the nearest starbase, where they're due to pick up medical supplies for colony on the outer limit of Starfleet's explored galaxies. Joe usually tunes this stuff out. So long as there are no away missions on the day's docket, he sticks to his own appointment schedule. Who cares exactly where they are in the vast expanse of space? DeGeneva cares a stupid amount, as evidenced by the little tick of his pinky finger when he glances over and finds Joe distracted. Less than perfect form, Joe should write him up. It's the constant battle between the smug desire to be the better person and the petty vindictiveness Joe strives to surpass that really characterizes his relationship to DeGeneva. Approximately 28 hours till arrival, the ensign finishes, and Joe jolts back to awareness. That can't be right. Excuse me? He hears himself ask. Seven heads snap in his direction. Joe really needs to start acting like he cares about status reports more often. It will be approximately 28 hours till arrival, the ensign repeats slowly. Her name is Lisa, and she gets so homesick sometimes she can't stop crying. Joe plasters a fake smile on his face. Thanks, Lisa. Sorry about that. Lost in thought. It's a good thing he's the only person in the room who can read an aura where everyone else would be drowning in his ode to what the fuck. The thing is, he is 95% certain their arrival time yesterday was also scheduled for 28 hours. By rights, they should be 4 hours away. Mentally, Joe runs through the rest of his day, oversleeping his alarm, skipping breakfast to not give Genova any more ammo, standing on the bridge when the captain and her first officer walked in. All of those could happen any day. Space travel just happens to be filled with so many monotonous sections. It would be pointless for Joe to attempt to note which constellations and asteroids they passed yesterday already. He could never manage that with landmarks when his parents decided an old-fashioned road trip through France was the best way to spend a summer, and at least those landmarks had the decency to actually look different. DeGeneva sighs heavily. It's uncharacteristically unprofessional of him, actually. And if Joe weren't busy freaking out, he would make a note of it. Say something catty, throwing DeGeneva's own words back at him. If you don't enjoy space travel, you should be back on Earth. Indeed, fuckface. It's only when Joe's 10 o'clock appears in the doorway and says, Joe, in your professional opinion, would building a distillery in a Jeffries tube be bad for my mental health? The Joe has to accept the incontrovertible. Today is the same as yesterday was. I don't know, Booker, he says absently. What are your motivations? Cynthia Hall blows, Booker says darkly, dropping into his seat on the other side of Joe's desk and immediately falling into his customary slouch. We've talked about self-medicating, Joe says, just like he did yesterday. Today, but the first time it happened, whatever. Joe's had this conversation before, and by the end of it, Booker's depression is no more healed than it ever was. But he is a step further away from starting illegal experiments in Starfleet property, and he and Joe have a holodeck bro date. Joe's notes have vanished. He realizes this when he's staring at the blank space where the elephant he doodled during Dr. Kozak's appointment yesterday used to be, while once again comforting her through accepting the ethical limitations of medical practice. Just because you can regrow organs these days doesn't mean you should make removing them a habit. By the end of Alpha Shift, Joe is about 45% certain he's going insane. The other 55%, he's pretty sure they flew through some weird space shit, like that time Booker was impregnated with the spirit of a weird interdimensional glow cloud. It's perfectly respectable to head for the freelancer the second his shift is over and to order the strongest drink Copley has available. Well, Joe mentally revises, not if you ask Joe's grandma, who gifted him with the compass when he joined Starfleet so he would always be able to find Mecca in his travels. He wasn't at the time able to adequately explain that a compass would only point north relative to the nearest magnetic pole in space, and also that his own relationship to faith was significantly less bound to the letter of the law than she would prefer. Still, she is the only person in this or any galaxy who has leave to question Joe's decision to drink disappointing Cynthia Hall cocktails before dinner. Niccolo DeGeneva has absolutely no right to plop down in the barstool beside Joe's and say, "That's unusual," about his choice of drink. It's been a rough day. Joe takes a deep sip through the twirly straw of his cocktail, turns on DeGeneva and demands, "Look, what the hell is your problem with me?" For a long moment, DeGeneva stares at him. Joe is just about to start apologizing and trying to reestablish their tenuous, somewhat professional relationship. Then DeGeneva says, "You won't remember this anyway, will you?" Leans in and kisses him. Chapter 2, Stardate 34895.3/54. Nikki. Yusuf Al-Kazani's beard is not regulation. His hair is not either, tied into a low bun at the back of his neck. Nikki had always thought, imagined, that it would be scratchy, unpleasant, largely an attempt to squash his own fantasies. It isn't. His hair is silk soft, where Nikki has one hand cupping the base of his skull, and the rasp of Joe's beard across Nikki's clean-shaven face makes something like a whimper catch in the back of Nikki's throat. Joe pulls away sharply. "How would I not remember that?" he asks. Nikki sighs. "It was nice while it lasted. Because tomorrow I will wake up, and it will be today again, and no one will remember." A frown line draws tight on Joe's forehead. One of the most attractive things about Joe are his laugh lines. The creases in his forehead, the proof of his well-lived, well-loved life. Nikki wonders why this is the first time he's tried kissing Joe in this endless parade of Tuesdays. Now he's said that, of course, Joe will subject him to a battery of tests. Under Medev Kozak's cold, unfriendly hands, he'll call Andy and Niall and they'll stay up till 2400 hours attempting to solve the mystery. And unfailingly, Nikki will wake up to the cruel, unfailing computer alarm at 600 hours with no idea of how he got to bed. He's gone through it enough times to know. "I know it sounds insane," he says wearily, "but..." Joe holds up a hand. "Wait, wait. You're telling me that you've lived through today already, too?" "Yes," Nikki says dully. 54 times. "Wait, you've lived today already as well?" "Only the once," Joe says with a nod. They stare at each other. There's a clink of glasses at the bar as Copley finishes drying them off. "Perhaps we should discuss this somewhere more private," Nikki suggests. It's not that he doesn't trust Copley per se. It's more that he sees no reason for a man on a starship to clean and dry glasses by hand. The water waste is ridiculous, and also Nikki doesn't trust him. He said as much when Andy hired him, but the bane of being chief of security is to perpetually give advice no one takes. Joe squints at him. "This isn't some weird, elaborate seduction technique, is it?" Heat prickles up the back of Nikki's neck. "Right. He kissed Joe full on the mouth not 2 minutes ago." His mouth opens of its own accord, and he can hear his own voice, stuffy and overly proper and ridiculous. "I'm sure you can sense my intentions," he says, and winces as he says it. "I don't use my senses on coworkers," Joe says stiffly, "and I'd appreciate it if you'd stop taking jabs at my heritage." He stalks off, and Nikki is left to follow him, reeling, through the whoosh of the freelancer's doors and down the hall. Ever since Andy introduced Joe as the new ship's counselor, referencing his half-Betazoid heritage as part of his qualification, Nikki has been off-kilter around him. In part, it was his own heritage, his half-Vulcan grandmother, and the way the entire family treated mixed heritage, as if it were a dirty secret to be kept under wraps. To find that here in Starfleet it was something to be proud of, even something to use for professional advancement, it was unbelievable. Nikki had thought for so many years that revealing his heritage would lead to being shunned and passed over for professional advancement, that meeting Joe made him feel profoundly and deeply stupid. He had known, after all, that his family was backward and wrong in many other ways. It was what had led him away from them and towards Starfleet in the first place. Why had he not realized they had been wrong about this? It took him nearly a week to realize his shock and surprise had made a bad first impression on Joe, and by that point, Nikki hadn't dared approach him. If he could sense emotions, well, he could surely also sense Nikki's debilitating attraction to him, and had chosen not to mention it, presumably to spare Nikki's feelings. Apparently, Nikki had been wrong about that as well. He's never been to Joe's quarters for obvious reasons, and he's tried not to imagine them to spare himself the pain. But if he had, he'd have imagined them like this, a brightly patterned quilt covering one wall, against regulation, but Nikki knew better than to say it out loud this time, an obscene amount of pillows on the couch and on the bed, a decent amount of clutter covering the desk and coffee table, some of it work, haphazardly stacked pads, and some of its souvenirs from the various planets they had visited, also against regulation, but Nikki has learned from experience that sometimes it was worse to refuse a gift. "So," Joe says, brusque and clearly irritated, "what have you worked out so far?" "It's nothing to do with any exterior factor," Nikki recites from his own log, which he had recorded over and over again for the first 30 days. "There have been no unusual asteroid formations. The warp drives are stable. None of the scientific staff have been working on anything related to temporal anomalies, and none of the planets in our last six missions have had the technology necessary to create something like this." "Nothing, then," Joe says. "You have worked out nothing." "Well, no." When the silence grows unbearable, he adds, Joe, I apologize for assuming you would use your abilities to... Joe makes a cutoff gesture with one hand. Shut up. Nikki's mouth snaps closed. I'm going to sleep on all this, Joe announces. And if tomorrow is today again, I don't know, I'll find you. He turns his back on Nikki and begins methodically stripping out of his uniform as if it isn't pure torture to Nikki to see the smooth planes of his back and the long lines of his legs revealed. Nikki got the posting in security because of his tactical mind. He knows when to retreat. He's almost out the door when he hears Joe mutter, This would be so much easier if you were a worse kisser. Chapter 3. Start at 34895.3/4. Niall. Niall figures out something is wrong when she sees Counselor Al-Khazani push Chief of Security to Geneva up against a door in a deserted hallway, mutter, It's not like this counts anyway, and kiss him like they're both dying. She had noticed beforehand that she was living through the same day repeatedly, of course. The replicator in her room is programmed to give her different breakfasts for every day of the week. It's pretty noticeable when you get oatmeal on what should be toast day. Since nothing else was broken or breaking, though, she'd run some scans and check some logs and use the rest of the time to practice a tricky trombone section she's meant to be performing Friday, whenever Friday finally happens. Perhaps, she thinks, watching DeGeneva melt into the wall, or possibly shatter into his component parts, when Al-Khazani slips him the tongue, she should have taken this more seriously. It's deep space, is all. Weird shit happens all the time. 2 weeks ago, they flew past a floating rectangle that made them all sing instead of talking. It wore off on its own after about a day, much like Niall had thought it would, but because everyone was aware it was happening, everyone was panicking about it. So they put in the effort, did the overtime, only to discover that the modulation of brain waves, thanks to the rectangle's innate electromagnetic waves, was just making everyone think everyone else was singing. Niall has some thoughts about Starfleet, accepting that which you cannot change, and work-life balance is all she's saying. She takes the turbolift up to the bridge and asks to see Andy in her ready room, because if whatever's going on is enough to get Al-Khazani and DeGeneva the hate fuck they've been angling for 3 years now, it's probably time to discuss. It's a shame, too. Niall had a bet running for the next non-denominational, it's probably winter somewhere party. So, she says pleasantly, swinging one leg over her chair in the ready room and dropping into a seat, it's Tuesday for the fourth time in a row. Andy winces. Not the fourth time in a row for you, then, Niall deducts. Nope. Andy pops the P. Should I be worried? Define worried, Andy says, carefully casual. Niall starts to get worried. How many Tuesdays, she asks in her best don't fuck with me tone, the one she's practiced on her baby brother every time it took away her Starfleet mug when she was 15, and still dreaming of being up there among the stars like her dad was before her. Andy looks away. 109, she says. Starfleet is a lot less glamorous and heroic than teenage Niall imagined it. What the fuck, Andy? She asks. It's complicated, Andy tries. When Niall gives her the don't fuck with me eyebrow, she adds, I've got it under control. Sure, Niall says. That's why you looked like I broke into your candy stash when I said I'd been reliving Tuesdays too. I'll fix it, Andy promises, which is marginally better. I don't think it's just me either, Niall warns. Can you tell me what's causing it? Andy doesn't respond. That's a yes I can, but I won't, if Niall's ever heard one, and serving under Andy has had way too many of those. She can guess what that means. With a sigh, Niall turns away from her and stalks out of the ready room. I am looking into this, she warns over her shoulder, and I really hope it stops. Nothing she's checked over in the last few days revealed any anomalies, and she doubts anything she checks over now will. She's going to do it because Andy clearly won't, but it's frustrating to always be the person who does their goddamn job, especially when the goddamn job is probably largely pointless. gentlemen, she snarls at Dejanova and Alkizani, on their post 10 minutes late and looking distinctly disheveled. Kind of you to join us. Dejanova, you have the helm. She goes down to engineering because if tomorrow is going to be today again, no one is going to complain to her about unprofessional behavior. Anyway, it counts as research. Hey, Book, she calls, vaulting up over one of the security railings to clamber into the Jeffries tube, where he's busy pretending to fix something or other. Fucking Jesus Christ on a stick, he mutters, dropping his pad next to the alibi wrench with a clang. Warn a guy. Reading romance novels on the job again, she asks, dropping into a cross-legged seat across from him. Shut up. Is it the one about the Cardassian princess? No. So it's the one about the Vulcan who falls in love with a Betazoid. Shut up. She laughs. Shouldn't she be on the bridge? He asks, clearly embarrassed. She shrugs. Weird space shit today. Anything I should care about? Is today the same as yesterday for you, too? Booker blinks at her for a long, slow moment, and with a sinking sensation, she realizes he's going to say something either heartbreaking or really stupid. How would I tell? She sighs and pats him on the shoulder. Never mind. Have you noticed anything else weird? He thinks. Joe blew off our therapy appointment. Probably for the best, she tells him. He's having a very confusing day. Can I show you something? Booker asks. Sure. He leads her over to the connector to the next Jeffries tube, and behind it she finds the biggest security hazard she's seen since the last Tribble incident. Sebastian, she says slowly, you are not. But I am, he says, perfectly calm and sanguine. I did all the math. It should be fine. When has that ever helped? She asks. Theoretical mathematics on a fucking starship. For fuck's sake, what if you get the warp core drunk? She's inanimate, Booker claims. But his voice must sound weak, even to himself. Under them, the ship rattles ominously. Chapter 4. Stardate 34895.3/109. Andy. How long are you going to do this for, Q? Andy asks the empty space where Niall just walked out. The rich sound of her laughter fills the ruddy room. Andy sighs and drops into her chair. Please, she tries. Please what? Q's hauntingly well-loved voice asks. Let me see you, Andy begs. She appears, first in a whisper of silk through the air, then in a glimmer of gold earrings, finally in the twisted curve of her smile. Quinn, Andy says. Andromache. Why are you doing this? Q drops into the chair Niall just vacated, apparently unconcerned that Andy is towering above her even more than usual. Did you know your chief engineer hasn't noticed it's the same day as yesterday in 2 weeks? Andy winces and makes a mental note to talk to Joe about Booker. Or that your chief of security is the most stubborn son of a bitch I've encountered. That Andy did know. Her mouth quirks in a smile despite herself. Nikki's come to her 20 different times trying to solve the mystery of the repeating Tuesday. She didn't have the heart to tell him it's not a solvable problem. Has it been good for him? She asks. Q blinks up at her. In terms of what? Personal growth, Andy shrugs, feeling more at home in his skin and this crew, all that. If you count giving your counselor head in a storage closet, yes, Q says. Damn it. If that sticks, Andy's going to owe Copley. Why don't you hate it? Q asks, her eyes abruptly shimmering away from the shade Andy remembers and loved into iridescence. Andy doesn't answer. All your life wasted in this, Q kicks at Andy's desk, in this flying tin can, watching your crew have the same petty problems over and over, nothing ever changing. Leaning against the desk, Andy dares to reach down and follow the line of Q's jaw with her thumb. It used to be your life, too. Q scoffs and pulls away sharply. The warmth of her skin lingers on Andy's fingertips. You are wasted on this life, Andromache, Q says coldly. So waste yours with me, Andy says. You have enough. Abruptly, Q lets her eyes fade back into the color they used to have, back when she was mortal, back when she was human, back when she was Andy's number one, and they flew through galaxies like they had nothing to fear and nothing to lose. "That's not how this works," she says. And Andy thinks for a split second that she hears something like mourning in Q's tone. "Better fix that warp core," Q says, the shape of her body already beginning to glimmer and disintegrate. "Last chance to make it out of here." Cursing, Andy races toward engineering. She could be wrong, but she thinks she hears the wind chime of Q's fading ethereal voice behind her. "Goodbye, love." The warp core is shimmering when she finds it, wobbling to and fro like it's a bowl of jelly and not the motor powering the whole ship. Klaxons started blaring when Andy was still in the airlift, the corridors filled with all non-essential personnel headed in the opposite direction. "What the fuck happened?" she yells as she drops down onto the platform. Niall, stripped down to the regulation tank top under her uniform, glares up at Andy over the sound of the wrench she's using to pull creaking bolts back into place. "Fucking Booker happened," she yells back, "and I am putting his ass on mandatory leave if we survive this." Booker winces from the other side of the warp core, where he appears to be overfilling the cooling liquid. "I don't know if hydrating is going to help her," he shouts over his shoulder. "What can I do?" Andy asks. "I don't know. What counteracts alcohol fumes?" Niall asks. "Dumbass over here decided to try distilling in an active starship, and the warp core hates it." Andy blinks slowly. "I have an idea," she says. "Is it an idea that's going to get us all killed?" Niall asks. "Maybe," Andy says, but with a whisper of Q's voice still in her ear, she says, "but have a little faith." Then she takes out her lighter and flicks it open over the rebelling warp core. The blaze throws them all back against the railings, brief but intense, until the fumes burn out of the air with a loud crack and the warp core recedes to its normal size. Niall lets her head thunk back against the railing. "I am not writing an incident report about all this." Chapter 5. Epilogue. Stardate 34895.4. Niall. Gingerly, Niall undoes the bandage around her leg. The skin is fully healed. Of course it is. This is the 23rd century. But her brain hasn't quite caught up yet. "Feeling better?" Celeste asks her, bustling over with a pad to scan Niall with. The medical blue looks really good against her skin, even if Niall knows she'd prefer to be wearing all black. "Yeah, thanks," Niall says, "right as rain." "You should try to stay out of active warp cores," Celeste frowns. "You promised me dinner once we reach Goosenville Station." Niall tangles her fingers and drops a quick kiss on Celeste's knuckles. "I know, baby," she says. Celeste flashes her a smile before drawing aside the privacy curtain and allowing Niall to get back to work. Hopefully there will be no more surprises today. Starfleet's not what Niall imagined when she was a kid, all flashy phaser battles and bringing peace and freedom to warring alien nations. It's a heck of a lot more fucking up and then trying frantically to fix it, and learning you were wrong all along, and finding family along the way. She flashes Booker a salute, where he's still laid up in his hospital bed. Celeste treating his burns extra slow so they could deliberate what kind of consequences his actions should have. He returns the salute with an apologetic shrug. Andy's waiting for her on the bridge. "It's Wednesday," Andy tells her out of the corner of her mouth. Niall nods. "You okay with that?" Andy smiles. "I'll live." Stardate 34895.4. Nikki. Nikki wakes to the blaring of an alarm. The pile of blankets next to him shifts. "M'wake," Joe mutters. "Thank you, computer." "You're welcome, Counselor Alkazani," the computer says. It's an interaction Nikki never considered the computer was capable of. With a groan, Joe swings his legs out of bed. The clock on the nightstand reads 6:50. Nikki will be late, and probably in yesterday's uniform. He doesn't care. "Jewel?" he asks tentatively. Joe blinks over at him, hazy and confused. Nikki wants to bundle him up in the blankets and leave him there for the rest of the day. "Hey," Joe says. His voice is rough from sleep. There's a love bite on his collarbone. "It's Wednesday," Nikki says. He would have woken up in his own bed otherwise. "Guess we'll both remember yesterday then," Joe says, running a hand through his already disheveled curls. "Will you have dinner with me tonight?" Nikki asks. He's entirely naked under the covers, his hair is a mess, and he's about to spend an 8-hour shift in yesterday's underwear. His heart is thrumming against his chest painfully. "Yeah, all right," Joe says. "Pick me up at 7. He vanishes into the bathroom and doesn't see the pleased little wriggle Nikki can't help but make against the sheets. If he notices the broad grin Nikki can't seem to suppress as they take up their stations, he's kind enough not to say anything. Stardate 34895.4, Joe. The debriefing is weird that day. The debriefing is weird most days, to be fair, but rarely does it start with a rundown of how many times in a row it was Tuesday. Joe can't claim he cares that much. It was a decent Tuesday. He could have done without the massive explosion in the engineering bay and the 4 hours he spent helping calm down freaked-out crew members, but otherwise, there were some pretty sweet highlights. Like the part where Nikki DeGenova got out between kisses that he's sorry he ever gave the impression he had a problem with Joe's heritage. He was just so tongue-tied around Joe, or the blissed-out confession when Joe had him sprawled out on the mattress, sucking delicately at the skin of his inner thighs, that he was wanted Joe ever since they first met. Somewhere between waking up next to DeGenova and watching him smile all day just at the thought of getting to have dinner with Joe, Joe has pieced together that maybe DeGenova wasn't on his case because he disliked Joe, possibly. "The guard to Alkizani," Niall mutters, elbowing Joe on the side. "Shift's not over yet, lover boy." "Ow," Joe mutters, rubbing his ribs, and "hey." "Oh, come on. I owe Copley his choice of favor now, and it's probably going to be weird," Niall tells him. "Couldn't you have waited an extra couple of months to jump his bones?" Joe ponders. "I mean, it was 2 months of Tuesdays for Nikki. Does that count?" "Maybe," Niall mutters. "Nikki now, is he?" Joe doesn't want to say that you call a man by his first name when he's rimmed you till you cried during work hours, so he just smirks as suggestively as he can. Across the table, Nikki catches his eye, and now that he has permission, Joe lets himself sense the cloud of emotion surrounding Nikki. Excitement, affection, something warm and cozy and tender that fills Joe's lungs to the brink as he inhales, and just a hint of nervous anxiety. Sounds about right for romance on a starship. Stardate 34895.4, Andy. There's a lull between beta and gamma shift. No one but the navigator and the pilot on deck. She steps to the front of the deck, looking out into the stars. From behind, all her navigator and pilot see is her stance, firm in regulation. Legs shoulder breadth apart, hands clasped behind her back. No one sees her blow a kiss towards the stars. The end.